Good morning. My name is Steve McConnell, and I am here this afternoon to give a presentation on the 10 most powerful ideas in software development. For those of you who are just joining us, copies of the slides are available at my company's website at www.constructs.com/Pearson, and Constructs is C-O-N-S-T-R-U-X .com, so Constructs with an X .com/Pearson. My name is Steve McConnell. I am the author of Code Complete, Rapid Development, Software Project Survival Guide, and most recently, Software Estimation, Demystifying the Black Art. And I'm very happy to be here this afternoon to talk about some higher-level topics in the industry, namely what seem to be the 10 most powerful ideas in software development. I think it's important to recognize that most of the key ideas in software development are not new. Software development has been around for more than 50 years at this point, and one of the pioneers in software engineering, Dave Parnas, was asked at a conference a few years ago, what are the most exciting or promising software engineering ideas or techniques on the horizon? And he said, I don't think that the most promising ideas are on the horizon. They are already here and have been here for years, but are not being used properly. And I think there's a lot of truth in that statement. In fact, many of the most powerful ideas are, in fact, pretty well known, but are just not being used as extensively as we might hope. The first most important idea, or most important idea number one, is the idea that software development work is performed by human beings. In the course of finishing my book on software estimation, I took a pretty deep dive into the best-known estimation model, which is called Kokomo 2. And while I have some reservations about the use of Kokomo 2 for estimation purposes, I will say that I think the statistical analysis that's gone into Kokomo 2 to analyzing the impacts of individual factors on project outcomes and analyzing those impacts in isolation is probably the most rigorous statistical analysis work that's been done in the software world. And so I think it provides some very interesting insights about what the major cost and schedule drivers are for software projects. And if you look at the Kokomo 2 model and the specific factors that it calls out, which are shown in slide 4 of the presentation, you can see that the most influential factor is product complexity. And that can make more than a factor of two difference in the total project effort. If you have a maximum complexity project versus a minimum complexity project, and that assumes all other factors are held equal. In other words, for a given size of project in lines of code, the most complex project will require, according to Kokomo, 2.38 times as much total effort as the least complex project, all other factors being equal. Now, that's number one, but then if you look at some of the other factors, we see quite a number of human factors. Analyst capability, that is, how good are the people doing the requirements work, has a factor of two impact on the outcome. Programmer capability, that is, how good are the programmers on the project, has almost a factor of two impact on the overall project. Personnel continuity, which refers to how much turnover you have, has about a 1.5 factor. If you add all these factors together, you find that there are about seven factors in the Kokomo model, each of which has significant impacts on project outcomes. Collectively, human influences make about a 14x or 14-fold difference in total project effort and cost, according to the Kokomo 2 model. If you look simply at the factors related to how good people are, that is, the capability factors, those alone make about a 3.5x or 3.5-fold difference. And if you look separately at the experience factors alone, that is, how much experience do people have working, doing the kind of work in the kind of environment they're working in and on the kind of business problems they're working on, those factors alone make about a 3-fold difference in project outcomes, that is, in total effort. And these variations exist across the board. They exist in experience, in knowledge of technology, in knowledge of the business, and, of course, in the personal processes that people use to get their work done. Now, the big news flash here is that this phenomenon is not by any means unique to software, that in fact, researchers have looked at how much variation there is in people doing other kinds of work including things like writing books, police detectives who make arrests, quarterbacks who throw touchdown passes, and so on. And they found that these 20-fold, roughly 20-fold differences among different people trying to do the same work are really true across the board. And so it's not unique to software. The implications of this, I think, and some pretty strong conclusions are, if the differences among different individuals are that strong, then that really helps to explain why startup companies like Google and Amazon in the old days and Microsoft in the really old days were very successful and continue to be successful, despite the fact that they're not well known for using really elaborate software processes. In fact, what this says is that up to a point, focusing on the humans and on recruiting practices, retention practices, and professional development of your people actually is the highest leverage control that you've got in software projects. And so focusing on the human factors actually makes a huge difference in project outcomes, and it's no accident that companies like Google and Amazon and Microsoft that are known for emphasizing the human contribution and for the lavish support they provide for their personnel, that it's no mistake that they actually do very, very well. Most important idea number two is the idea that incrementalism is essential. Now, I want to make a differentiation here between two different terms that are often used as synonyms, but for today's purposes, we need to tease those apart. Incrementalism is the use of a series of regular additions or contributions to arrive at an end. That end might or might not be known in advance. With an iterative approach, you, by definition, don't know the end in advance, but with an incremental approach, you might know the end in advance, although you don't have to. The key part of incrementalism is that you're doing things one little bit at a time rather than in larger chunks. There are numerous benefits that you get from incrementalism in software, and the top three are feedback. More specifically, by doing things bit by bit, you get feedback on the software itself. Are you building the right thing? Are you building it in the right way? You get feedback on the development process. Are you using the right kinds of practices to build the software? And you get feedback on the people and on your development capability. How quickly are people working? Are the project plans accurate? The feedback tells you whether they are or whether they need to be revised. And, of course, I think you also get the ability to adapt. The tighter the feedback loop is, the greater ability you have to make mid-course corrections, and the smaller the corrections have to be effective. The sooner you can make them and the smaller they have to be, and so incrementalism really provides valuable support for feedback, and that in turn provides valuable support for adapting in ways that help you run projects effectively. One of the sayings that we have at Constructs is if the map and the terrain disagree, trust the terrain. And what that means is the feedback from the live project gives you much more useful information than your plans do. And if the plans and the project reality disagree, then what's right? Well, the project reality has to be considered to be definitive, and so people need to pay attention to that. And short increments help get a better sense of what the project terrain really is. Most important idea number three, and I'll repeat for those of you who might be joining us a little bit late, the slides for the presentation can be found at constructs.com, that's constructs.com/Pearson, and we are currently on slide 13. So most important idea number three is the idea that iteration is essential. Iteration is related to but somewhat different than incrementalism. Iteration is the idea that you are going to recite or perform a second time. That is, you are going to repeat something. And you are going to converge toward a solution bit by bit. With iteration, you don't know the result in advance. And one of the reasons that you iterate is so that you can zero in on the results over time. Now, the funny thing about this is that what we found over the years is that people are not computers. When you do the same thing over and over again, you don't necessarily get the same result. In fact, people become better at what they do. They learn lessons, and so practice actually helps. And doing the same thing over and over again actually can be a good thing. We have this saying in software that doing the same thing over and over and expecting different results is one definition of insanity. In fact, I think that there's a new definition that is somewhat relevant too, which is that not doing the same thing over because you think the results won't change could be another definition of insanity. Indeed, in software, doing the same thing a few times to learn from it and get better at it, I think, is a core practice. In fact, one of the most important ideas in software development. I have, in fact, something I like to talk about, which is the software silly meter. And I think this is a pretty heavy talk, the most powerful ideas in software development. Yet I think that this idea that you can get things right the first time is clearly one of the sillier ideas out there. And there really are two variations on this on different endpoints of the scale. An idea that I think is especially silly is that the only two development options in existence are iterate nothing and iterate everything. In other words, the only two development options are the waterfall model, which has essentially no iteration, or completely iterative models like extreme programming, which want you to iterate everything. In fact, I think that there are lots of valid points between those two extremes of iterate nothing and iterate everything. And what we need to recognize is that some practices derive their power from incrementalism, that is, doing a little bit at a time. Some practices derive their power from iteration, that is, repeating the same task again and again with the intent of finally getting it right. We should also recognize that we can iterate within an activity or a phase, that is, we can iterate within requirements and take multiple attempts to get the requirements right, for example, or we can iterate across pairs of activities or phases. For example, we might have requirements in architecture, we might do the requirements, then dive into the architecture, and then realize that we need to make some changes in the requirements, and so iterate back on the requirements and go back into the architecture. We certainly can also iterate across the entire development cycle, that is, do a little bit of requirements, then a little bit of architecture, then a little bit of construction and a little bit of testing, and then go back and do another cycle of that. And the important thing to recognize is that the degree of iteration can vary from practically 0 to 100%, either within an activity or across activities. And an important part of project planning, then, is to try to determine what degree of iteration is going to be most useful and when that iteration should actually occur. Most powerful idea number four is the idea that the cost to fix a defect increases over time. There's an interesting chart that's shown on slide 22 that shows the way that costs increase as defects stay in process. And this is one of the most replicated results in software engineering research, and really it just stands to reason. Software development is a process of building on essentially pure thought stuff. The early thought stuff is the requirements, the later thought stuff is the architecture and design, and even if you take a very highly iterative approach where you're doing tiny bits of requirements work, then design work, then construction, then testing, it's much cheaper to correct your defect when all you've got is the requirement than it is to have to throw away the work you've done on architecture, design, construction, testing, and so on. The industry research on this says that, on average, it's somewhere between 2% and 0.5% of the cost to fix a defect very early in the project as it is to fix that same defect late in the project, so somewhere between 0.5% and 2% of the cost on average. Or another way of putting it is that those defects that slip through till the end of the project on average cost somewhere between 50 to 200 times as much to correct late in the project as they would have cost to correct earlier. So what do we do about that? Well, I think what we find is that we've had some discussion in recent years, especially associated with agile programming. It says that agile projects really aren't affected by the defect cost increase or DCI dynamic, and this is just one of the latest in a long series of silly ideas. What we find is that in fact no projects are immune to this dynamic. The real variable is how well do projects respond to it. And it turns out that defect creation is a function of effort. That is, for every hour you work, you're going to insert X number of defects into the software. That's not a variable. That's a constant. What's variable is the defect detection and removal is a function of QA activities. And if you don't perform the QA activities, you don't remove the defects early when they're cheap. You save them until they're late and very expensive. And so projects get into trouble when they don't closely follow their defect creation activities with their defect detection and removal activities. And unfortunately, that's pretty much average practice today. Most projects don't really try to detect and correct defects until they begin system testing. By that time, it's too late to get cheap defect correction, and so we try to encourage companies to begin those activities much, much earlier. Most powerful idea number five is that there's an important kernel of truth in the waterfall model. For those of you who are following along, we're now on slide 28. There's a very familiar picture that shows a number of rectangles arranged in a cascading order from upper left to lower right. I think that this picture has been very commonly presented as a depiction of the waterfall model. And there's no question that the waterfall model is problematic. But I like to quote Jessica Rabbit from the movie Who Framed Roger Rabbit, who says, "I'm not bad, I'm just drawn that way." And I think to some degree that idea applies to the waterfall model as well. It certainly has its limitations, but I think the way it's drawn is actually a fairly major problem. And if you take a step back and look at the way that activities tend to flow on a project, as shown on slide 29, typically early in the project, our focus really is on discovery, that is, on requirements work. And the reason I use the word discovery is that I think the most critical aspect of requirements work is, in fact, the act of discovering what functionality the users want. There certainly are challenges associated with capturing those requirements once you discover them, but I think the defining challenge in the requirements work really is not the challenge of capturing the requirements or documenting them or even working out inconsistencies. The really defining activity is that of discovering requirements. So that tends to be the major emphasis early in the project. As you move into the middle of the project, the emphasis moves more toward invention. Now, usually we refer to that as design, but again, here I think that the defining attribute of design really is the need to invent solutions to the problems that were discovered during the requirements phase. So capturing the design is certainly also an important activity, but invention is the hardest part, I think. And then finally, we move into construction. And interestingly enough, discovery is fairly open-ended. We don't really know what we're going to discover when we start working on discovery. That's the nature of discovery. Invention is also somewhat open-ended. That is, we don't know what the solution is in advance. That's why we have to invent it. If the work is done well, however, construction can be a little bit more deterministic and a little bit less open-ended because we are actually just really trying to realize in code the invented solutions to the problems that were discovered during requirements. One of the other aspects of this diagram shown on slide 29 that's important is the fact that these activities overlap. And software development really is what's known as a wicked problem. A wicked problem is one that cannot be fully defined until it has been at least partially solved. And the wickedness is the fact that you have to begin solving it before you even know fully what the problem is. And that really is, I think, the nature of software. There are times when we can't fully define the requirements until we put something that looks like working software in front of the users and they tell us, okay, that's not what I want. Now that I see it, I know that that's not what I want. Well, that is very much indicative of a wicked problem. Similarly, sometimes we can't really make key architecture decisions until we write some code to see how those architecture decisions are going to play out, and that's more wickedness. So I think that's really the main reason that the waterfall model has been so problematic over the years, is that it's really based on the assumption that it's possible to do all the requirements work, then all the design work, then all the coding work, then all the testing work, and it doesn't account for software projects' inherent wickedness or the wicked problem aspect. Now, the fact that some overlap occurs does not mean that that's a good thing or that we should just accept it. In fact, every time we have overlap in activities or wickedness, that implies that there are dependencies, it increases uncertainty and risk, it creates the possibility of rework as we do work based on prior work that's not completely done yet, and that ultimately leads to higher costs, longer schedules, and lower quality. And so, really, our goal here is to recognize that there's inherent wickedness in software projects, but we can take steps to make to attack that wickedness and make them less wicked. So my conclusions are, some degree of wickedness is indeed inevitable, and you should account for that in your plans. However, a lot of the wickedness that project teams run into is avoidable, and through careful planning and project execution, you can, in fact, avoid that. And I think that the final conclusion for me is that you should attack wickedness actively, and here, incremental and iterative approaches are really your strongest allies. The more wicked the problem is, the more it calls for a higher degree of incrementalism and iteration. Most powerful idea number 6 is the idea that the ability to create useful software estimates can be improved over time. This is also known as the cone of uncertainty. On slide 33, you see a depiction of the cone of uncertainty. For those of you joining late, the slides can be found at constructs.com/Pearson. The cone basically says that very early in the project, at, say, early product definition time, even skilled estimators will create estimates that vary enormously in their range about the final outcome. And researchers have found that at the very beginning of a project, at early product definition time, different skilled estimators will create estimates that are up to a factor of 4 high compared to whatever the final outcome ultimately turns out to be, or a factor of 4 on the low side. In other words, there's about a 16x total variation in the estimates that will be created even by skilled estimators. And it's important to recognize that the variation here is not variation in estimation expertise. The estimates might actually be pretty accurate. The variability is coming from the project itself. That is, we haven't pinned down all the details of what the software is going to be. And so that variation in the estimates, even if it's a 16x variation, is actually an accurate reflection of the variability that is still contained in the project. So it's not that the estimates are inaccurate, it's that the project itself is in some sense inaccurate or contains a high degree of variability. Now, as we work our way into the project, by the time we get the requirements and the user interface pinned down in detail, we actually have taken that 16x variability and we have shrunk it to a factor of 1.5x, so a dramatic reduction in variability. And typically that takes about 30% of the schedule on the project, and that's a round number, but in round numbers 30%, and takes something like 10 to 20% of the total project budget. Those are, again, round numbers, but it takes less budget than schedule. Typically you're having a small senior team that's doing that kind of work. Now, the other important thing to recognize is that the cone of uncertainty is by no means a guarantee. The cone of uncertainty is what you get when skilled estimators are applying good estimation practices and you actually are attacking sources of variability and reducing the variability in your project. If you don't do that, if you have unskilled estimators or if you aren't able to attack the variability, then you can end up with what I refer to as the cloud of uncertainty. And that cloud of uncertainty can persist really for the entire duration of the project. The cone shows a nice narrowing where about 30% of the way into the project you get pretty good long-range visibility about the project outcome. However, if you have a cloud of uncertainty instead, you can have a great deal of uncertainty about the outcome right up until a few days before the project is done. And so if you have ever worked on a project where you got 90% done and then you stayed 90% done for the next 6 months, well, that's a great example of the cloud of uncertainty, and clearly we see estimations that are created all the time that are not created by skilled estimators, and so we certainly can do much worse than the cone. We just can't do better. So takeaways here, I think, are estimation needs to be iterative. That is, those very early in the project estimates can't be very accurate because of or are going to contain a high degree of variability if they're accurate because of the cone. And so that means we need to plan to re-estimate at various points as we work our way through the project. It also suggests that project planning needs to be incremental. Early in the project, we don't really have a very good idea of what the scope of the project is going to be. We can't make meaningful plans if we don't have an idea of the scope. And so as our idea of the scope is refined, our project plans need to be refined along with that. And a final implication is that an estimate really isn't meaningful, especially early in the project, unless the estimate describes how much inaccuracy or how much variability there is in the project at that point in time. So in the past, I've really stated this as saying the estimate needs to contain a description of its inaccuracy, but I think more accurately, an estimate needs to contain a description of how much variability exists in the project. Most powerful idea number 7, the most powerful form of reuse is full reuse. And this is an idea that has evolved quite a bit over time. 20 years ago, I think our biggest idea was that we could reuse code. That is, we would take the executing source code and we would pull that out and use it in another application. Later we got the idea that we could reuse the code and we could probably reuse some of the design. The current idea really is that we should try to reuse as much as possible, including the designs, the code, the test cases, and I think perhaps more significantly, processes and plans. And that's something people don't talk about reusing as much, but I think that's actually probably easier and possibly higher leverage than some of these more traditional forms of reuse. If you take a look on slide 37, I have a diagram of the effect of adding process the first time you add process, which is what I wrote in my book, Software Project Survival Guide, back in 1997. And what I said is that you're always going to have some amount of thrashing on a project, shown here by the red area on the top of the graph. Then I think people who think are concerned about the overhead of adding process will show that process actually does eat into the amount of time you have to do productive work. But the point I made back in 1997 was that, yeah, there's a lot of process overhead early on, but as you work your way through a project, you get the processes ingrained in the way you're doing the project, and you can end up finishing much faster than it seems like you're starting once you internalize those processes. Well, with the benefit of 10 years hindsight, I think I was, in fact, somewhat optimistic back in 1997. And if you look at the diagram on slide 38, I think that the first time a project team starts to use processes or a more process-oriented approach, it will indeed introduce overhead, but much more overhead than I thought back in 1997. Teams end up spending a lot of time on issues like, well, what does a well-formed requirement look like, and how should we capture requirement, and what tool or document should we use, and how should we organize the document, and what does the table of contents look like for a design document? And there are all kinds of questions like that that simply take a lot of time to resolve. And so for first-time usage, I think the impact of adding process is actually worse than I thought. But once you've asked those questions, later uses, that is second use, third use, fourth use, in fact, all the ensuing uses beyond, you don't have to ask all those questions again, or at least you don't have to ask them as deeply or as naively as you asked them the first time. You've got an idea of what a well-formed requirement looks like. You've got an idea of how you're going to capture requirements. You have an idea of what a design document looks like and how deep you want to go in the designs and so on. And so on the second, third, fourth, and so on, later projects, the process overhead is actually better than I thought back in 1997. You simply have to go through maybe a bit of a bigger hurdle to get there than I originally thought. So I think overall the news is good. It's just a little bit bigger hump to get over initially. So what are the conclusions here? Well, one conclusion is that there are a lot of things you can reuse. You can reuse coding standards, change control policies. You can reuse procedures for estimating. Not many companies do, but that's a very powerful practice. You can reuse the formats and outlines of various documents, including project plans, requirements, designs, quality assurance plans, test plans, and so on. Another great form of reuse is checklists. Checklists are a very low overhead, lightweight way of capturing organizational wisdom, and you can create checklists that help you to make sure that you're doing a good job with your plans, your estimates, change control, inspections, coding, test cases, QA, and so on. Another thing that you can reuse that we've had very good experiences with at Constructs is roles and responsibilities. If you clearly define various roles like the individual developer contributor role, the individual test contributor role, the construction lead role, requirements lead, design lead, configuration management lead, and so on, it makes it really easy as you get into planning a project to say, okay, we're going to have Joe take on the role of design lead on this project, and Joe knows what that means because the role is being reused. And you say, Abdul is going to take on the role of requirements lead, and Abdul knows what that means because that role has been well defined in advance. And if you work your way partway through a project and you say, okay, we're going to transition, the role of requirements lead from Abdul to Jessica. We need to have Abdul take off the requirements lead hat, Jessica put it on. it's easy to know what that implies because the role is well defined. And because people have run into those roles on past projects, they know what to expect of each other, and that makes for a really smooth transition. Most powerful idea number 8 is the idea that risk management provides critical insights into many core software development issues. We differentiate between two types of risks, those that are called extrinsic and those that are intrinsic. I'm on slide 42 now. Extrinsic risk management is really the kind of risk management activity that you think of normally when you think of risk management. These are activities that you add onto the project expressly for purpose of managing risk. So activities like creating a top 10 risk list, creating risk management plans for each risk, appointing a risk officer, and so on. These are fine practices, but I think that another kind of risk management that is at least as important, probably more important, is intrinsic risk management. These are practices that you build into the project primarily for other reasons. You don't think of them as mainly risk management practices, but they tend to have the effect of attacking generic common project risks and have a strong risk reduction effect on those generic risks, and as such have a strong risk reduction effect on the project itself. So some examples include things like active project tracking, that is, knowing with clarity what the real status of your project is. Well, we don't think of that as risk management, but the fact is the better, clearer view you have of your project status, the sooner you're going to tend to take corrective action when things start to go wrong. And that just really improves your risk management posture across the board. So while not thought of as a risk management practice per se, it has a strong risk management benefit. User interface prototyping. Again, you don't think of that as a risk management practice, but it addresses the very common project risk that users don't know what they want, and they won't know what they want until they see it. By putting a user interface prototype in front of them, you don't have to go through the whole development cycle to show them what they're getting, and they can say either, yeah, that's what I want, or no, that's not what I want. End user involvement, another practice very similar. We don't think of it as risk management, but one of the most common problems is creating software that an isolated number of people think is the right kind of, meets the right requirements, but then when you give it to the real users, they say, gosh, no, this is, we could see how you might think that, but that's not really our issue. Getting end users involved reduces all kinds of risks related to requirements. Same thing for incremental delivery. It addresses all kinds of technical risks. Upstream technical reviews address risks of defects not getting detected until much later when they're more expensive to fix. So there are lots of different kinds of intrinsic risk management practices. And what we're typically looking for, as shown on slide 44, is with risk management, is that we consciously increase the amount of what you might think of as overhead, shown by the lower green bar, in exchange for a dramatic reduction in the unplanned variable work that typically occurs on most projects. The average project spends more than half of its total effort on unplanned work, and the biggest source of that is unplanned defect correction work, which makes up somewhere between 50 and 80% of the total effort on the average project. Nobody ever plans to spend 50 to 80% of their total project budget on defect correction work. That wouldn't really be a rational plan, and yet that's what we find projects doing. And so employing a little bit of deliberate increase in the deliberate work in the project can dramatically reduce the unplanned work in the project, and that's a good trade-off. So it turns out that risk is actually the key to many tough decisions in project management. What's the best lifecycle model? Should you use spiral? Should you use some modified waterfall? Should you use evolutionary prototyping? Should you use stage delivery? Well, I don't know. Ask what risk you think the lifecycle model is addressing, and what lifecycle model is going to address the risks of your specific project. How much requirements work should you do? Well, what risk are you trying to address with the requirements? Are you trying to address the risk that the users don't communicate clearly what the requirements are? Are you trying to address the risk that the users themselves don't really know what the requirements are? Are you trying to address the risk that you've got a lot of staff turnover, so you think you can do a good job of capturing the requirements, but or of discovering the requirements, but people might need to be able to read about them in a comprehensive way later on? Well, let the risk that you're talking about drive the amount and kind of requirements work. Same general analysis applies to design work and applies to use of junior versus senior staff, design reviews, and so on. One of the sillier ideas out there, is the idea that, which some companies have when we start talking about risk, is the idea that, oh, we're an entrepreneurial company. We can't be afraid of risk. And the silliness here is not separating the business risk from the project risk and not separating either of those from the product risk. These are all separable, and indeed we should separate them. Most powerful idea number 9 is the idea that different kinds of software call for different kinds of software development. And what we find is that people in different camps will tend to view the world as trying to fit into their worldview. So if the whole world looks like a hammer, if the only tool you've got is a hammer, the whole world looks like a nail. And on slide 49, I've got a couple of quotes that illustrate this. The first is that the pace of information technology change is accelerating, and agile methods adapt to change better than discipline methods. Therefore, agile methods will take over the IT world. Or the exact opposite statement. Quote, software development is uncertain, and the software CMM improves predictability. Therefore, all software developers should use the software CMM. Well, I think it's very clear that there is no one single development approach that works best for all projects. One of the things I like to do in my spare time is home improvement projects, and one of the things I've learned is that I can use a lot of different tools for my home improvement projects. I can use a circular saw. I can use a chop saw. Sometimes I need to use a Sawzall. Sometimes I need to use a table saw. Sometimes I need to use a jigsaw. Sometimes I need to use an old-fashioned handsaw or even a hacksaw. Or sometimes I need to use a coping saw. Or every once in a while, I don't actually have one of these, but I might need to cut down a tree with a long two-person saw. Or, more modern, and I actually would use this as a chainsaw. And the big news flash here is, guess what? Software development is just as difficult as sawing. And if we need that many different kinds of saws, why on earth would we think that we wouldn't need that many different kinds of software development practices? And in fact, clearly, the different kinds of practices, different kinds of software projects do indeed call for different software development practices. The last idea we'll talk about today, most important idea number 10, I think is the software engineering body of knowledge, also called SWEBOK. SWEBOK identifies 10 different knowledge areas, including configuration management, construction, design, engineering management, engineering process, maintenance, quality, requirements, testing, and tools and methods. And I think there are some interesting implications of the SWEBOK. Aristotle made the comment 2,400 years ago that to organize something is to understand it. And what we found is that by applying the SWEBOK as an organizational framework, it brings a great deal of clarity to our software development practices, to learning about software development practices, organizing materials that support software development practices, discussing software development practices, looking at strengths and weaknesses of software organizations. Really, there's a great deal of clarity across the board. And the alternatives really are not good. The alternatives are basically muddiness in thinking and talking and writing about software development, or treating software as something that is so complicated or so ineffable that only gurus and experts can understand it, and that just isn't a good approach. And so we've found that the SWEBOK provides a wide spectrum of support for software development practices, including defined or reusable software development processes, academic curriculum guidelines, career development for people already working in the field, certification of software professionals. We've had really good success using it as a framework for interviewing software candidates, where we can say, you know, how good was this person in requirements, how deep were they in design, how deep were they in construction, and so on. And then that can be used to create a technical skills inventory and say, well, we've got this many people who are at this level in design, we've got that many people who are at that level in requirements, and can help you plan out what skills you might need to be developing for the future. Is SWEBOK the ultimate answer? I don't think so, but I believe the comment that Francis Bacon, the father of modern science, made when he said the truth will sooner come out of error than from confusion. I think the value of SWEBOK is that it plants a stake in the ground, and that stake might be wrong or it might be right, but at least it gives us a clear point to argue about. And we can apply the ideas of incrementalism and iteration and iterate towards something that is more correct than the current version is. And indeed, I think you could apply that standard to this entire talk. Are these the final 10 most powerful ideas in software development for all time? Probably not, but at least there's a stake in the ground. It gives us something to talk about, And over time, we can iterate toward a better set. And with that, I am going to go ahead and open the phone lines for questions.
The leader has muted your line.
Did anyone have any comments or questions this afternoon? Let's try that again. Instead of unmuting the phone lines, I muted them again. So is there anyone who has any comments or questions this afternoon?
If I have a question.
Yes, go ahead.
You were talking about the variation in programmer expertise. I think it was Paul Graham who pointed out that the interesting thing about that variation is that it's not matched by a variation in salaries. You get somebody that's 20 times as good, and they don't cost 20 times as much. So you should generally – so really, you save money by hiring more expensive people. I was wondering if you have a reaction to that.
Oh, I think that's absolutely true. I think that if you look at variation in programmer salaries, you've got, in round numbers, probably about a 2.5x change between the highest paid programmers and the lowest paid programmers, that is, within a given industry and geographic area. And so, yeah, sometimes people will draw the wrong conclusion from that. They'll say, well, if the best programmers are 20 times as productive as the worst, they should get 20 times as much. There's some truth in that, but the truth isn't what you think it is. The people will say, well, if the worst programmer is getting $50,000, the best programmer should get, you know, $500,000. Really, what it probably means is that the worst programmers are grossly overpaid, and the worst programmer, in terms of value to the organization, only worth like $10,000 a year or something like that. Indeed, in a lot of cases, they're worth negative amounts. They're actually doing damage to the organization. So it's certainly true that the best programmers are probably worth more than they get paid, but I think even more true is that the worst programmers are worth less than they get paid. And a company that wants to take advantage of that differential by aiming its hiring policies toward the top end of the talent pool, I think that's a very good economic decision. Are there any other comments or questions? All right. Well, thank you all for joining us this afternoon. And if you have any follow-up comments or questions, please feel free to email me. My email address is stevemcc@constructs.com. stevemcc@constructs.com. I'd be happy to hear from you. Enjoy your afternoon. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Steve.